Welcome to the Wags of SCI podcast, where we discuss life, love, and caregiving after spinal cord injury. Hosted by Elena Pauly and Brooke Paget. This podcast is proudly sponsored by Wishart Brain and Spine Law. Led by our personal mentor and lawyer, Robin Wishart, Wishart Brain and Spine Law is a uniquely specialized law firm located in Vancouver, British Columbia.
They focus their practice on complex spinal cord injury and traumatic brain injury cases, and they work with clients all over North America as advocates and a much-needed resource in the spinal cord injury community.
Robin and her team look at their clients differently than other firms. You're not just a case, you're a person with a family, a life, and a purpose.
They are always looking for ways to help improve the quality of life for their clients by providing the support they need for their recovery, such as assisting with insurance and benefits paperwork, finding resources for home adaptations, setting up medical appointments with doctors and specialists, and making sure that their clients are doing physically and mentally okay.
Wishart Brain and Spine Law is proud to support Wags of SCI. Robin is committed to helping clients and their families any way that she can, because she wants you to live your life and not your claim.
Your first consultation is always free. So contact them at brainandspinelaw.com and make sure to mention that the Wags of SCI sent you. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Wags of SCI podcast with your hosts, Elena Pauly and Brooke Paget. Today, we have a special treat for you guys and somebody who can truly relate and give us real life advice to everybody in this community.
Yes, we're super excited. We have Tricia Wallace. She is a clinical counselor here in British Columbia. Both Elena and I have had the pleasure of working with her personally in our own time. Her background is really interesting. So she has 31 years of nursing experience in the field of mental health, and that is with adults of all ages in hospital and community settings. She also has worked as a nurse educator at the University of British Columbia and Langara College. So in 2019, Tricia finished her training in counseling psychology, developing skills in many areas of therapy, including 10-month practicum in addiction recovery. She has a lot of experience working with anxiety, mood disorders, thought disorders, dementias, Parkinson's disease, multiple system atrophy, motor neuron diseases, head injuries, impulse control disorders, and addictions. She also specialized in counseling for caregivers and family members who often experience intense stress but lack support. So we're going to talk to Tricia today about her experiences, her background, how she started, and what she specializes in. And we're hoping through this podcast, we can kind of get rid of some of the stigmas that come with addressing your own mental health and looking after your own mental health and what you can do as a caregiver and what your partner can do to try and heal from a traumatic injury and from the stress that comes alongside with that from both partners. So welcome to the podcast, Tricia.
Thank you. I am really happy to be here. I'm really, really interested in exploring this discussion more.
Yeah, we're very happy to have you here. And we have a lot of questions to get into. And we would love to know how you got here, like what your experience was. I know you had been a nurse for so long, and Elena and I are both really interested in getting into that with you, because that's, you've got to have some interesting stories about that, correct?
Yeah, well, you know, I think being a nurse is, you know, you just get a chance to meet so many different people and really gain different perspectives. And I found that my mental health work was really important to look at the biological, psychological, social, and spiritual aspects of people. So that's kind of like the groundwork of nursing, right? It's very diverse. It's about what people's experiences are about in their own context. And it was interesting to work in the healthcare system too, because, you know, you'd see people in hospital and there's the institutions like hospitals thrive on sameness, right? So it's like, you know, same time, medication, same eating, you know, all the groups and stuff they go to. And then you go into the community and you really get to see where all the nuances and the gray areas are. So I always have noticed, and I think working with clients is making that transition from hospital to community, and kind of making your own rules, for example, and what that means for you. It's a tough thing to do, because you've got rules from the doctors and rules from the therapists and, you know, family rules and everything else that kind of come together in the home setting. So I thought that nursing really has helped me to understand that even better for people.
Yeah, definitely. That is a big leap when you are released from rehab with a huge prescription, a list of prescriptions to tackle, and all the exercises and all the mindfulness and all of the fluids you're supposed to be drinking and all the other rules, like you were saying. It's kind of cool for us because we've been, I guess we're sort of like from the other side of things, right? Brooke and I have had our fair share of beliefs around nurses too, but you're certainly not the regular sort of nurse that we've experienced going through rehab. So, you know, one of the big things that you say is the full holistic approach to the practice that you do, which is not just 100% biological. And that is a very, very cool part of your practice. So thank you so, so much for coming on again. Now what is it exactly that, like, when did you know that you wanted to be a nurse? Was there something that happened or something that was a something that you chased your entire life?
Well, I was always sort of a very heart-centered kid, you know, and really, you know, sort of right-brained, emotional kind of person. And I wanted to really be involved somehow with people. But didn't really find nursing until my early 20s. So I didn't grow up thinking, oh, I'm going to be a nurser, you know. I was more interested in the arts and, you know, acting and this sort of thing. And ended up finding nursing and loved it, like, right from the very moment. And then I did a regular nursing program. We actually lived in the hospital and, you know, it was kind of the olden days. And but I did my psych rotation, the last rotation. And that was it. I was just, this is definitely what I want to do. So I just, you know, ended up working in psychiatry, doing my practicum, and just starting my nursing life in psychiatry. And I've remained there ever since.
So clearly you have a lot of interest in the human brain and how the human brain works.
Very much so. Very much so. And I'm sure a lot of us can say that our family histories provide us with, you know, interest and exploration and curiosity, you know, as we think, oh, I'm trying to figure yourself out, you're trying to figure your family out. And that always kind of drives, I think, this fascination for me as well. Also to be sort of practically creative. I remember putting that on my application for nursing school, like, sort of like, I want to help people, but it has to be sort of, I want to be creative with my support. I want to kind of bring that flexibility into my caring approach.
Did you ever feel like frustrated in your profession? Like, did you ever get to a place where, you know, we were talking to a doctor last week on the podcast and he was talking about how some of his colleagues just get so frustrated with the system. And did you find any sort of frustration or limitations within the mental health system?
Oh, yes. I mean, bureaucracies are, I did. I'm sure every nurse does every day. And so it's like having to make, you know, sometimes a lot of the times it's like a dilemma. There's two choices, both of them aren't very good. And you got to make one. You know, I think that's a big leap when I was working with nursing students, is they would learn, we'd teach them all this great stuff about the possibilities. And then they get into these settings and it's like so confining for them. And it's a really big transition to sort of decide, okay, what can I do given all the limitations that are rife in the system? And how can I still basically see the person in context? And that is huge. I think if we stick with that as a philosophy, that's what's really going to help us you know, really see what's going on. Because I'm sure you guys have always had that lot of maybe bad experiences. I know I have as a patient and as, you know, family caregiver. Like, you're just like, why do you have to make that decision when the person could just come 15 minutes early, or you could just do that? You know, there's so many different things that choices people could make, and you wonder why not. That typically is just their sense of, they just feel like they don't have a choice for a lot of very, very good reasons. And students, when I work with them, they kind of go, well, how come we don't do it like that? And I'll go, yeah, I had forgotten about that. You know, students have this fresh perspective on how to do things well and how to still stay within the lines and the guidelines that the institution, you know, prescribes.
Mm-hmm. That is a very good point, isn't it, Brooke? Why don't we do it a little bit differently? Why don't we move on with the times, or with fresh ideas, or with maybe, you know, new innovative ways to do things? So what would you say, Patricia, sets your practice and your philosophies and, you know, your view of how to treat the patient? What sets you apart from any other therapist, or what would you say?
I think what might make me unique is that I do have some understanding of biological processes a little bit more. I have an understanding of sort of healthcare navigation and systems support, which counselors, if they've just trained purely in counseling, they might not have that background. So I might be able to guide people as to how to speak with their case managers, or, you know, things that they might want to clarify more specifically with their family doctors. I'm not going to give medical advice, but I could, you know, understand a medication that they're taking and say, oh, okay, well, that might add to your insomnia, or that might add to, your foggy brain or whatever. So I think that's something that sets me apart from other counselors.
I think that's a really, then that's why we were drawn to you too, mm-hmm. is because as soon as we saw that, we were like, okay, this is a super good combination, because you have the Western and Eastern practices that you participate in, and just having the knowledge of both is just, for us, is huge, because there's so many things that Western medicine misses because of like what you're talking about, because of the system, because of the structure, because of the mentalities of Western medicine and how to treat from the top down versus the bottom up, or a combination of the two. This is kind of like a generalized question. I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit. Let's talk about choice for a second before we get into, you know, the techniques that you use and stuff, and some of your favorite techniques. Let's talk about choice, because I know this is a big thing nowadays, especially when it comes to mental health and empowering yourself and finding your container and your sense of empowerment in who you are and making choices in alignment with that. Based on your experience in, you know, psychiatric nursing and dealing with some probably very, quote, sick people, do you think that in general, people have a choice over their own mental health?
I think that's super difficult to explore, and a very good question. There are biological processes that are going on. There are psychological protection mechanisms that click into place for us all. And I don't think we have a lot of choice around those at times in our lives, right? However, I think with the process of diagnoses and the way that the system works right now, we really objectify people. And it can be hard to find, hard for people to then either, if they fight and they want to get autonomy and they make choices, they can be really categorized as being unruly and difficult and, you know, not going with the program, et cetera. The So yeah, the choice really can, at times our brains are commandeered, right? If I get really, really, really depressed and I become psychotic as a result of that, meaning that I kind of lose touch with reality and I think people are after me or something like that, then I don't really have a choice around that. But the decisions day by day, minute by minute, people do have choices around, no matter how, you know, ill they get, we can help them find their choices. And it might be as small as, you know, asking them, what they want on their tray or not, you know, their food tray, or, giving them a little bit of leeway about taking a medication before or after their meal or something like that. That is small, but it offers that sense that they can make some choices. And of course, those then offer confidence and a sense of trust in themselves. And then they snowball, of course, bigger choices. Like one big one is the choice to live at risk. And that becomes really murky and difficult, which is why I think if practitioners use the Mental Health Act in a way that is the way it's supposed to be, which is to protect individuals who are showing, you know, signs of mental illness challenges, there is room. There's actually quite a lot of room to live at risk. For example,
can you expand on living at risk?
Yeah, I mean, living at risk is essentially finding out the edges at which we have the autonomy to make choices that might put us at risk. So, someone rides a mountain bike down a mountain, they're actually engaged in a pretty risky situation, right? And yet we might be afraid that someone under our care wants to not put a belt on when they're in a chair, or they don't wear a helmet when they have vestibular problems and they might fall back and smash their head and be really, really sick. But they don't want to do that. They're choosing to live at risk. Someone who doesn't swallow well, but they really want to eat food that they really, really love because it gives them some quality in their life. That's living at big risk.
That is risky living. This happened to my mom, actually. Sorry, just to cut in here. Yeah. As you know, Patricia, my mom has Parkinson's, and she was staying at the UBC Stats Center just a few months ago. And I was so excited to come and bring her some little dumplings and these little Russian pierogies that I had made her. And she took it secretly into her room, which she wasn't supposed to have. And this exact same thing happened, where she was unable to swallow properly without an attendant. And then, you know, it was a bigger issue from that. And it almost developed into pneumonia. So I understand. But so I think that, you know, when you bring up swallowing, we think that this is just like a natural biological sort of response. Our body will just do these things, you know. Same with, you know, if you're not having proper motor skills and you're a little bit wobbly and off balance, but we expect people just to do these things without really thinking about it. And one thing I just wanted to say when I cut in here, though, is it's very cool to be able to sort of have this sort of education while you're here with us, have this education that we would otherwise not be able to receive over little stories like swallowing or walking or putting on your helmet when you're thinking, hey, I don't really need to, or that seatbelt. And these are just really quick decisions that we make in our lives. You know, sometimes it's just that 1 second that can really change your life. And I think that it's important to sort of, you know, especially in our SEI world with our partners, it was just 1 second, one little thing that just changed our lives. That I think is just really, it's kind of cool just to be so, I don't want to use the word mindful about it, but it's just crazy how in just a second things can really change, can't they?
They sure can. They sure can. And that is why it's such a stressful, ethically charged life, you know, when you there's a lot at risk, and yet there's also the person who's living with the injury who wants to have a sense of control as well, and make their own decisions and be their own person. And so being able to even talk about this stuff, you know, if someone's deciding, sometimes, as we all do, we hyper focus on things when we're under stress. So the argument might be about a seatbelt, for example, but it's really about something else as well. And so how do you maybe talk about what's going on emotionally in order to decide, okay, I will wear my seatbelt, but I do need some choices in other areas of my life. What's that going to look like for me? And then all of a sudden, the moments that become hypercharged and that, you know, people can have a lot of fights around, become more about unmet needs and less about arguing over one particular action or one particular choice.
Yeah, that's such a good point. 'Cause in our community, it tends to be the little things that make the big things. And, you know, there's so much frustration floating around between in a partnership with someone with a spinal cord injury and in a partnership where, you know, the female may be doing the majority of the caregiving, or maybe she's not the caregiver. Maybe she's keeping the house together and dealing with the kids. And it just, you know, all of those stresses combined, the little things are what make people explode, right? I'm sure you've seen that very, very often, is people don't like to get to the bottom of things because it's scary, right? And it involves like that sense of vulnerability. And like, you know, you're already vulnerable with your partner when you're in our kind of coupling, in our situation, you're already vulnerable on both ends. And it's almost like you want to keep a little sense of stuff to yourself, but it's interesting how this partnership requires you to step over that boundary even more into more vulnerability, into more communication skills that they're not just something you know how to do, right? Like, would you say that in situations like ours, communication skills are developed and not necessarily innate?
Most of the time, people have everything they need already. It's a matter of working through the fear around saying things. And I could talk a little bit more about that later. And it's also around that sense that, when do I have the time? Oh, like you're already pushed to the very, very limits with like morning to night doing stuff, like so much stuff that you're doing. And just to conceive of the possibility of spending maybe half an hour or a whole hour of your busy day talking about stuff that makes both of you feel super uncomfortable and it's ambiguous. You don't know, will this work or will it make things worse? That's a huge step to take, to be able to kind of go, okay, we got to try this. And the question usually is, could it get any worse? Like, right. You know, there gets to that point where people just go like, okay, this is not working no matter what we're trying. Let's try something else and see if we can shift gears. And so I'm very well aware of how to, you know, set the stage for that. And, you know, you don't go for each other's jugulars and really go for it, right? It's a matter of creating a safe space just to start talking to one another.
Okay. So can you walk us through how to create a safe space? What does that mean for anybody listening right now thinking, you know, my life is chaos. I'm going to go drop off the kids. I have to take care of my partner. I work full time. Yes, of course we need to have time to be able to put forward for your partner and for your relationship. But how does one go about to create a safe space, Patricia?
Well, a lot of it has to do with sort of limiting the ambiguity around the discussions. So that might mean making a specific time for one another. So, and it could be as short as 5 minutes. It could be as short as checking in using an exercise of some sort where you just kind of talk about what's going right to start off with instead of what's going wrong. So you're just sort of engaging in discussion that's different than it's breaking maybe a cycle of conversation that might be, how are you going? What do you need? This isn't working. Oh, you know, like sort of like patterns that you might get into as a couple. So sort of disrupting some of those. And realizing that at the other end of it, both of you aren't spent. So you don't like sit there for 2 hours getting into it and then being both just wasted by the end of it. You just sort of structure the time and both of you follow those rules that's done. Even if one of you might want to follow the other one. What do you mean by that? I want to talk more about that. Nope. You've had your time together to explore things. But what you got to do before that situation as well, of course, is work on grounding and being in a space where you're cool. So you strike while the iron is cool as well. So you find a place for both of you before you start talking where you're not revved up. And another thing you can do is things like, you know, Gottman Institute talks about the love map, for example, as a couple, where you get to know each other by asking each other questions on a sheet about who you are, what your interests are, what your likes are. Because as couples, quite often we think we know our partners because we've been with them for so long, but we're all evolving. And sometimes we see our partners stuck in a certain time frame and we're not necessarily looking at them in the now. And that's super important. And I'm going to go on and on here. So I want to wait and just check in with you guys.
No, I think those are really, really powerful tips because, you know, I know there might be some people out there that eye roll at this kind of stuff, but this is the kind of stuff putting effort into 5-10 minutes and allocating time each day consistently is so huge. I always like to think of little things every day consistently make the most change. And it's like, you're never going to get in trouble and you're never going to cause any issues when you're working on yourself, right? This is the kind of stuff that should take priority for me, to be honest. Like, it's 5 minutes, it's 10 minutes. Everybody has that, especially when you're with your partner. Like, we have a lot of excuses in our community, like, oh, I can't take, you know, even 10 minutes away from my partner because he's on a vent. Well, okay. This makes it so that you can do something to work on yourselves, but also working together for 10 minutes. You know, everybody has that kind of time and it's something that you should almost schedule in because even though it seems silly to people, it's really about building, right?
Yeah. And scheduling is super important. I think this whole idea of mindfulness where everyone thinks you have to sit on the mat and it's 30 minutes and at least they say, you know, 30 minutes to an hour a day, it's so important, da, da, da. But the reality is that mindfulness is an attitude, right? It's a philosophy. It's an attitude. And it's basically about paying attention to the moment without judgment.
I think this is a really good time to get into your favorite practices and techniques that you've seen the most improvement in couples that you've had therapy sessions with or individuals. What are your favorite? Like, what are some of your favorite techniques or philosophies that you like to draw on?
Well, first thing I want to say, I am eclectic, so I don't kind of use one philosophy in particular, but I do. Take a trauma-informed approach. So again, looking at how events can affect the body and the mind, the bottom up, as you had noted before. And I do like mindfulness-based cognitive behavioral therapy for anxiety and depression, mild to moderate depression. It's really well studied. It's super successful. I like using acceptance and commitment therapy as well, because that really explores personal values and the rules that guide our decisions. So often those are happening behind the scenes without us even knowing. And then when we start to bring up these personal rules, it's like, oh yes, that's what was going on. And we look at the genesis of those rules and we look at the possibility of making a choice to either continue to follow those rules or say, yeah, this rule worked really well for me. But it's not working for me now. So I have a choice to kind of look at things in a different way. And I also kind of just look at people's language, like and their attitudes, and make a decision about what might work for them. So like Gestalt, some people like the big picture, and they're very, you know, they're very artistic. They want to look at physicality sometimes. You know, some people, I like the two chair method, for example, where you would, you know, parts of yourself, you talk to parts of yourself, or you sit in one chair and you take on that approach and that attitude, then you physically get up and walk over to another chair and take an approach and an attitude. And I've done that with people at home on video as well as in the room. And I also like Adlerian work for talking about people's family roles and sort of their life roles, because there's lots of really good language and approaches in that in Adlerian work.
Very cool. All right. I really like the two-chair method that you were just speaking about. I think that's a really good perspective, because sometimes, you know, it's hard to separate the thoughts that are in your head that are really not even you, right? And I really like how you said to sit in it, you know, to observe without judgment. How many of us in this life, especially 2021, there's so much going on in the media, so much going on with our families, that sitting in it and just being, you know, in the uncomfortable without judgment is a really, really cool approach. Can you speak to us a little bit more about that? How would somebody go about, you know, like what are they sitting in? How does somebody even acknowledge these thoughts? Can you just speak to us a little bit more?
Yeah, sure. And I think that's really interesting, that whole sitting with it, you know, outside of the language that people might use for mindful practice. It's like, what the heck? What does that mean? You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, it really is just about paying attention, right? To the body. So typically what you would do first of all is you'd ground yourself to the moment. So the idea is that typically we are either mining the past. When we're stressed out, we're trying to figure things out. We're trying to fix a problem, and our brain can click into overdrive. Alternatively, our brain kind of shuts off, but we can talk about that later. But we're basically looking for a decision, you know, figuring things out. So we mine the past for our mistakes and try and figure out what went wrong, or all the stuff that information we think will be from our past experience. And we also leap into the future and get into the what if questions and try and figure out situations so that we prevent problems. And so mindfulness is really about noticing the moment that we're actually living in, because that's actually where we are, right? And it's about noticing that our bodies are with us. Our bodies go through all this stuff our whole lives. But somehow when we think about how to support or help us through emotional stuff, we go up into our heads. We kind of forget that our bodies are there with us. And yet it's noticing the body in the moment that helps us to settle things down better. It actually helps us ground to the moment to be able to use the natural processes we have in our bodies to settle down. And so, for example, we would orient to the room, just sort of look around. Notice where things are in this room. Overstate the fact that you're actually here in the moment. Put your feet on the ground. Notice the contact of your body with your chair. Notice the positioning of your body. Take a couple deep breaths. And then just pay attention, for example, to the breath. And you don't have to pay attention to the whole breath and all of its, you know, fancy dancy types of breathing they have out there. That's great if you can do it. But it typically can be just noticing the tip of your nose if you're starting out. And the fact that your breath is a little bit cooler as you inhale. So you're really starting to pay attention to your body, and you might notice that the floor is still and the chair is supporting you. And you feel your breath. And if your mind starts to wander, use that Kabat-Zinn example of the mind is like a puppy. It wanders away and you pick it up gently and you bring it back to the moment. And it will wander away, bring it back to the moment. And that's basically what that sense of being in the moment is. And then the body starts to realize, hey, okay, I notice the sense and I'm actually safe right now in this moment. And then there's just a whole world of opportunities that open up for us to change our breathing and sense, hey, I have control over my breathing. I didn't think I did 10 minutes ago when I was having a panic attack and I could barely breathe. So, you can change your body. You can do lots of different things. It just opens us up. But we have to kind of first start in the moment. And, a breath is a really long time for a brain. I know you guys have probably heard me say this. It is. Our brains are working so fast. So if we can take a breath or two before we weigh in on something, that gives our brain time to go, okay, there might be an alternative here, rather than an automatic reaction that we might otherwise come up with.
That was so awesome. I feel like you have a real gift for, you should be on a talking meditation, Patricia.
On a tape.
Yeah. We were both just like totally zenned out. I was like, oh, this, we shouldn't be doing this during a podcast, but it's like, oh, that's so relaxing. I'm sure our listeners would probably feel the same, but that just kind of goes to show you how powerful, just breathing and paying attention to your breath and getting in the moment can be. It's kind of like, that's like kind of a taste of meditation, really. So everybody out there who's scared of getting into a meditation or who hasn't devoted any time to meditation, you just experience 30 seconds of that, which kind of shows you just how relaxing it can really be. If we can just quickly circle back just a little bit. I know there's a lot of women in our community and there's a lot of men in our community who are injured that don't even know what their stress response is. I know I've kind of had that happen to me early on where I've experienced some physical symptoms where I had no idea that it was the actual physiological response to stress and overwhelm. Can you outline just some of your most prolific or like your most obvious stress-related symptoms that are actually physiological processes going on so that people can identify them more?
Sure. Most of us have heard about the fight and flight, right? That sort of stress response that happens really quickly. We have these things called catecholamines, which are adrenaline and dopamine and noradrenaline that sort of start pumping through our veins. We get cortisol that also kind of numb us just in case we're going to get in trouble. It's very primitive brain stuff. Protective, primal sense of safety that kind of clicks in our bodies automatically. And that is something that we need. And we can have a lower levels of activation like that that are actually really important for us to pay attention and to have the energy to do what we have to do. But in the stress response, as it evolves, it can really lock in. And not only are there fight and flight, there's also freezing. And freezing is part of a system. There's like the sympathetic nervous system, which is that fight and flight activation system that kind of gets going. There's also another automatic nervous part of the nervous system called the parasympathetic nervous system. Those two systems are sort of supposed to balance each other out. But under stress and under chronic stress, usually the sympathetic nervous system is like always on, and the parasympathetic nervous system, that rest and digest system, is barely kind of moving, barely functioning. So there's fight and flight with the sympathetic nervous system, and there's also the parasympathetic nervous system and the sympathetic nervous system kind of go together, and they do something called like shutdown. It's like a, it's like you're kind of frozen, you're sort of stuck. And this again is, they think, I've heard that it's like because of there are certain animals or something where, you know, ancient humans had to stay perfectly still, and if they did, they wouldn't be attacked, so they sort of stay really, really still. And so that sort of this most primitive experience can come to us. And there's another one that I think is really important in the stress response, which is something that theorists are calling like the please appease approach, which is to show that everything's going just fine and sequester or push down our feelings, because there's a fear that we can't actually show what's really going on. There's too much at stake if we do actually talk about what's going on. There's a fear there. And, you know, some in extreme situations, there's a fear of, you know, physical or emotional harm. But there's also could be a fear that something catastrophic will happen if we actually say what we want to say. So I kind of look at the fight, flight, freeze, please and appease. Those sort of four elements of this response. And it's, there's different ways to sort of measure it and talk about it. One strategy I use is the window of tolerance, which I use with almost all of my clients. And it talks about being in the center of a window, and imagine it is an actual window shape. And that's kind of where you tolerate things well. So you might be activated, you might be stressed out almost to the max, but you feel like overall you got this. You got the tools. You know it's going to be over soon. You're going to push it, and then you're going to get a chance to relax. You're going to get a chance to feel a little bit of relief. So that's kind of in a window of tolerance. And then what happens is we get really activated as we start to go to the edges of the window of our tolerance, and we can become super activated, like having all of the things like a dry mouth and shaky hands and sweating and our heart's pounding. It's hard to breathe. Our brains get all foggy, and there's all that's a sympathetic nervous system. It's because that's getting us ready to fight or run away. So all the blood's like leaving our guts. Our guts get really upset, and it's making our mouths dry so that we don't, you know, choke on anything in our mouth. It's taking, you know, blood away from our brain. So our brains get super limited, and we're just going to go yes or no, black and white, right? Because you don't want to be ambiguous or sort of ambivalent if there's like a lion staring at you. You're not going to go, oh, I wonder what that lion is. Which way should I go? Like, you're just going to go. You're just going to get out of there. You're going to fight it. And so that's the type of like primitive kind of response we have when we're considering to be above the window of tolerance. But then there's this kind of shutdown freeze mode below the window of tolerance as well. And that is reserved for avoidance, procrastination. Tim Urban calls it the dark playground, that sort of grinding place where we know we're supposed to do stuff, but we can't. You almost like physically can't move with this kind of, it doesn't kind of register as I'm anxious. It just registers as like a ugh, and it can also feel like numbness and depression and kind of heaviness. That's all what happens below the window of tolerance. So we know stress makes the window of tolerance smaller, and it can be very, very small at times. And we know that some people might lean or, you know, tend to fall into one or the other areas above or below the window, or some of us bounce back and forth all over the place. So yeah, so then I can say to people, if you know that window of tolerance language, you get a chance to know where you're at. That gives you a chance then to figure out how to get back to the center of the window. And that can be through, yeah, different, totally lots of different strategies, mindfulness, you know, attention, doing some, you know, lots of different activities that you can do to help you get back to the center of the window. And when you're in there, you can reflect on, how did I get outside my window? What was I needing? What was I really thinking? I was so stressed out. I didn't actually have time to reflect on what I was feeling or what I was thinking there. And that helps you create a language of needs and a language of, oh, okay, this makes sense now. I get it. I got there so fast. What happens is we have these patterns, these grooved patterns of neural responses when we feel super stressed out. And they typically come throughout our whole lives. It can even, you know, theories suggest that they're actually in utero and even, you know, intergenerational trauma. This type of experience in our nervous system creates these super locked in physiological patterns. So first we have to be aware of those patternings happening. And then we can say, okay, you don't have to go into all the information about why, what happened in your past. You don't have to, like, you know, tell your story of trauma over and over again. You want to look at what's going on with your body right now and how are those patterns pushing you around, making you do things you don't want to do, creating situations that are difficult for you. How do you sort of figure those out first? And that usually helps you to cope better. And then you can decide if you want to move forward with more discussion about your past and all your history. That's really important at times, but you don't always have to do that when you're looking at this response, the body's response in the moment to what's going on with high levels of stress. That's going off, I would say.
No, that information is so very helpful. And I know it probably sparked a lot of little seeds were planted in a lot of our listeners' brains. And this kind of information is just, it's so helpful because you don't hear this kind of information, like, just to expand on what Elena was saying earlier. You don't hear this kind of information in the news or in the media. You don't hear it from people, really, unless they've gone to therapy. And even then, it's not really their job to enlighten you, or unless you're into reading, right? And even then, this is the kind of things that you can only get when you talk to somebody like you. And just, you know, this information alone is just, it's so helpful. And it's interesting, too, because in our community, I know there's been so many times when, you know, even myself, and I know Elena and a lot of our, the women that we talk to haven't really understood what's happening, or how to find their window of tolerance. They've just kind of gotten to the edge of their window of tolerance and they haven't really been able to navigate that back, or know what was going on until they've experienced it. And then I feel like it's such a good opportunity in a way, because going through that, where you literally hit your edge of tolerance and you don't know what's happening and you're just so overwhelmed, it kind of brings you to a place where you're like, okay, how do I, like, investigate this so that this can be better managed next time? And even, oh, I see what my window of tolerance is now. I see what my edge is now. How can I work so it doesn't get here again? And I feel like that's truly kind of a gift in a way, because there's not a lot of people that get shown that so obviously, other than WAGs. Like, I feel like, you know, it's very,
I was just going to say that.
Right?
Yeah. Other than a WAG of SCI who's gone through these situations over and over and over again and truly wants to, you know, behave differently or have a different trigger response or whatnot.
Well, you guys are, like, you know, to me, this is like your wise mentors, right? This is how humans coped with the extraordinary stresses they've had throughout history. they've had wise mentors. People lived in villages. People lived in groups, that all of this wisdom could be there for generations of women. And here the two of you are sort of creating this, you know, a really incredible community for people to be able to connect in this way and share stories that, yes, you are the people who know it. You need to find people like that, to be able to really work through this stuff. And then, you know, people like me come along, maybe give some ideas about what, you know, different strategies and different approaches to take. And one of the big things is, what is your body telling you now? Because our alarm bells go off all the time. And when you're in positions like you guys are, where you're so busy all the time, it's like, oh, you just don't pay attention to the alarm bells anymore because there's no friggin' time. Right. And so this is a matter of, like, if that's why mindfulness, just to, you know, bring it full circle again, that's why mindfulness is really, really important, because it's actually paying attention to the messages that your body has been telling you all the time. And you're just giving it space to do that. And it could be 3 minutes in the car while you're waiting outside. Go a little early, park. And then for 3 minutes, just, oh, sorry, I didn't turn off my, you know, here's life, right? Here's an example. Yeah. I'm talking about mindfulness and bling, bling, all of my Microsoft team starts coming in. It's just important to try and do that and say, hey, what's my body doing now? You can not pay attention to the message. You could, but you want to, like, notice that the message is there.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good point about showing up a little bit early, because especially when you're so busy and you're most likely going to be running late, to set it up a little bit earlier, right, Brooke? Especially for the WAG of SCI life.
Well, yeah. And I also think that for a lot of us, there needs to be a perspective shift that happens at some point where you just get to the point where you're like, okay, I can't live like this anymore, constantly, like, strung out on stress hormones. It's getting worse and worse. And, you know, you start to feel physical pains in your body that come and go with your emotions. And it doesn't need to get to that point. But unfortunately, as humans, we respond extremely well when we're put in a place of, like, discomfort. You can either go, right. It's like your body is telling you something and you have to listen. So I'm so glad you said that, because we've been conditioned in our society that you run away from those things or you medicate those things and you don't listen to what your body is telling you. And I truly believe that in the next 10 years, especially with all this, you know, new age stuff coming out and all this, you know, stuff going mainstream as far as healing your body, because your body is a source of trauma, it's going to be more mainstream. And it's going to be people kind of breaking out of the cycles of going to their doctor and getting medication instead of going within and recognizing what your body is trying to tell you, because your body is there for a reason, right? It's not just an appendage, you know, that has been, you know, created. It's like your body's there to show you. And it's like a cycle. It's like a loop. It's there to show you what is going on and if it's in alignment with who you are and if it's not in alignment with who you are. And I'm really glad that you're kind of bringing this full circle into a clinical practice, because this is so, so, so important. I mean, we both know what stress pains feel like, right, Elena?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Preach, girl, it's like preach. Sick exhaustion. It's like a really weird, it's a really, really difficult place to, you know, it's really hard to feel
navigate. And especially with our culture and, like, Western culture, where it's, you know, we heavily celebrate, and this is something Brooke and I have talked about on and off, where we heavily rely and celebrate cocktails of the week. Each day has a special cocktail, that it's so easy to sort of fall into that. You know, it's like, it's Mimosa Monday. Let's treat all of our stresses with Mimosa Monday, Tequila Tuesday, and so on. That, you know, of course, this is sort of like how our society celebrates, like, reward yourself, sit down, have a drink. And then, you know, we've seen where that goes as well, especially with the high stress of being a WAG of SCI. It's, you know, it's nice to have a fresh perspective where it's not always dependent on medication, big pharma, alcohol, or drugs, which are the quick fixes sometimes. And It's kind of nice to step out of the mind, you know, getting into the mindfulness, the yoga practice, because it is a natural high for our bodies. There's so many different other practices we can do, like the cold water dipping. I've seen a group of, you know, a community going into the ocean for a little dip during the very cold spring months. So there are so many other techniques and things that we can do that can be, that can become so nourishing that it's almost addictive, that I think that it's really cool to be able to have people like yourself on today, Trisha, to be able to shine a new perspective of, you know, using your breath and doing things. One of the most important things that you said so far is you already have everything you need within yourself to be able to sort through anything. So again, thank you for that. You know, that's very powerful. And I think that's a very strong, an important reminder is that you already have everything you need within yourself.
Yeah. And you don't even have to be a spiritual being to like understand that. It's like you have all the resources within you. You just have to kind of, you know, be willing to seek those out, be willing to like look within. I don't know if you would agree with this, Trisha, but do you agree with like, I feel like a lot of what happens when you start investing time within yourself, and I've seen this on our self-care group a lot, where people are just like, well, of course, time is a big thing, is where like they use the time thing as like a big, big roadblock. I don't have the time. Because they haven't gotten to a place where they've reached their breaking point yet. And they don't want to devote that time because they're just like, no, it's just, I don't have the time. And then the second one is when they start doing some practices outside of their comfort zone in order to like nourish their soul, whether it's taking half an hour to read or working on breath or doing yoga. I feel like a lot of the time people give up on that because they don't see instant results. And, what are your thoughts on that? The whole like instant gratification thing that comes from taking an Ativan and calming yourself down versus actually working on yourself and the time it takes and the length of time it takes to actually see a difference and the combination of using different tools.
Well, you know, yeah, mindfulness is about skill building for emotional weather. Right. So we know we're not going to, be good at it. As a matter of fact, I like Dan Harris is super clear and super circumscribed with this. You know, you try, everyone says this. So you try, you fail, you try, you fail. You absolutely will fail when you're doing mindfulness practices, like breathing practices, anything where you have to stay in the moment. And it's, you don't have to do anything other than bring your mind back. If you bring your mind back, then it's a win. You're doing it right. If you notice yourself leaving the moment, you are successful in mindfulness practice, because that's basically what it's about. It's noticing your body and noticing when you leave the moment as the start for the practices itself. And another thing I want to say is this, and I, you know, I live with a lot of anxiety. I've lived with mood stuff in my life. It's like, you know, if you're super geared up and then you go do some sitting mindfulness, it's like too big of a gap between being super, you know, outside of your window and then sitting still. So you don't have to sit still to be mindful. Find a practice that works for you. It could be standing mindfulness. It could be Qigong and using your body as you move. You can, first thing first is to kind of get out of that window, is also to be physical as well. So that might mean, I call it like my worry box. It's like you do something physical. That could be just getting up outside and go outside and close your eyes and feel the cool air on your face for 5 minutes. Like physically shift gears first. That's why orienting and sort of grounding is really important before you actually go into the mindfulness piece. So part of it is, first of all, like I agree with you, is that we expect things to work right away and they typically won't. We won't register them as working, but they probably are working, right? So any sort of time we can pump the brakes, stay in the moment for a bit, our body goes, ooh, okay, this is interesting. I could like this. And the more we do that, the patterning, the neural patterning goes, oh, we get more used to that. And we get more and more and more used to that. And that takes us off the tracks of worry, of anger, of that anxiety out of window of tolerance place. We get somewhere else.
You know who talks about this a lot is my favorite guy, if you've been listening, all our listeners out there, Michael Singer. He always talks about this. He always compares it to a chemistry class and a tennis lesson. And he's like, listen, mindfulness is not something that you go into and you are perfect at it right away, like what you were saying. He's like, think about yourself walking into AP chemistry in grade 12. He's like, you don't walk in there and start doing your lessons and walk out because you can't do it. That's why you're in chemistry class. You've come to learn, right? You don't go into a tennis court on your first tennis lesson and you really suck. And you don't walk out because you really suck. You stay there and you take your lessons. And sometimes it takes years. And so I feel like it's funny because a lot of people I know have been like, oh, I've tried meditation. I've tried mindfulness and I can't sit still and I can't focus. And it's like, well, have you done it for months or years? Have you done it for every day for 21 days? Have you done it every day for a certain period of time? Oh no, I only did it like 3 times. Okay. Well, would you expect to go into AP chemistry and write the exam to get into university? No, like these are things that take practice. And from someone who has myself gone through a lot this past couple of years, trying to train myself to get out of overactive, worrisome thinking, and really noticing those thoughts and where they come from, it's not something that happens overnight. It's a very gradual process. And so I feel like people just shouldn't give up on themselves before they really start, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's judgment, right?
Right.
If we judge ourselves, it's like that's the difference between mindfulness and other stuff in our lives. There is no, it's an ambiguous, embodied experience when we are mindful. So there's no scaling, there's no gold stars, like there's nothing, there's no belt levels like in martial arts. Like you're just gonna be there and know when you're there. And so if we think of it as anything differently, we're actually judging ourselves. So just go back to the sort of the original philosophy and attitude of mindfulness, which is to just be present with yourself without judgment. And even thinking about that is engaging in mindfulness.
Mm-hmm. That's very good. Well, Tricia, you're just one of the people that we're so lucky to come across to have in our toolbox. And as Brooke and I always say, we're always trying to gather our girl gang, so to speak. And you are local, you're Canadian, you're another fierce female. We're so grateful to have you on. And, you know, we've taken up already an hour of your time, but before we let you go, if you could give us any piece of advice for our community, for the women who are hustling and the men who are now, you know, their lives have changed and this is their new body, this is their new mind. If you could give us a piece of advice, one big piece of advice, what would it be?
I think keeping the lines of communication open for within yourself to kind of notice what you're saying to yourself, be honest and try and click into experiences that you're having. You might not share it with your partner at this time, but write it down, figure out how you want to talk about it. And, you know, same with people living with, you know, the physical injury itself. To be able to be honest, stay connected, build new connections with other people, and express your needs when you can. And that helps as well. If you're finding you're around other people who, before the injury, for example, used to be really connected and now they just seem to have not be in your life. Maybe that's where they're needing to be, but it could be that they don't know what to do and they don't know how to do it. And so if you can figure out what you need and ask them directly for that and sort of guide people as well in your supportive circle to share what you need, you'll be able to keep people in your life and build and maintain relationships as well, because it's the connectivity and it's the support, like this type of support that Wags of Psi gives people, is what really helps you make it through.
Amazing advice. Thank you so much, Tricia, for being on. Now, anyone listening that wants to contact Tricia, she does a lot of virtual sessions, especially with COVID now. And she's available on her website at Azir Health. It's AISIRhealth.ca. You can find so much more information on her specialties and more about her and services. You can email her from there and you can contact her from there. And if you want us to connect you with Patricia, we can definitely do that as well. You can email us at wagsofsci@gmail.com. I do love this about the pandemic, how everything's been made more available online and more accessible for people all over the world virtually. It's been truly amazing. And I know you do a lot of your work online, so we're super grateful for that. Are there any other avenues in which people can contact you if they'd like to contact you?
I think, yeah, typically it's through calling me, and my number's on the website. And so usually just leave a voicemail with me, a confidential voicemail, and I'll be sure to get back to you as soon as I can.
Perfect. Thank you so much for coming on, Tricia. I just wanted to quickly leave a little bit of a personal quick note for anybody listening right now who may be struggling with anxiety, depression, grief, and are kind of on the beginning stages of their journey where they're looking into this and they know something's missing and they want to start working on themselves and they want to kind of go down this path of, you know, self-love and working on yourself and getting into a plan that works for you. Just know that you're not alone. I mean, the narrative in the media right now is not focused on personal growth by any means. Just know mm-hmm. that behind the scenes, there are so, so, so many people going through transitions right now and upgrading themselves and looking within and trying to find answers. And this is, you know, part of where consciousness is going, and this is where the world is going. And so you're not alone with what you're going through, and you have an amazing support group in the Wags of SCI that can help you and connect you with people like Patricia when you're going through this stuff so that you can work on it. And I also wanted to say that Elaine and I always talk about this in our personal conversations. Working on yourself is like, literally, we like to call it the warrior's path. It's not easy. It's something that sets you apart from everybody else. It's something that is not instantly gratifying. It takes work and it takes a commitment to yourself. And it's something that you should be incredibly proud of, that your soul is kind of leading you in this direction. So anyone out there that needed to hear that, you know, it can be a struggle, but you have a great community here. So we just wanted to thank you for tuning in once again and supporting our podcast and supporting the great guests like Patricia and supporting yourself and all the resources that we're trying to provide you and your partner and your community in your own area. And yeah, if you need any other support, you can always go to our website, wagsofsci.com or contact us, wagsofsci@gmail.com. So thank you again for tuning in to this week's podcast. And thank you again to Tricia.
Thank you both. Glad to be here.
Until next time, be nice to each other, love each other, and take care of yourselves. Cheers. Until next time. Be nice to each other, love each other, and take care of yourselves.